Welcome to the RAND CRE Show. Commercial real estate with no stone left unturned.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the RAND CRE Show. I'm your host, Mike Tarvella. And today, I'm super excited to have our guest, Ryan Daigle. Ryan is a 20-year vet of the software industry. He is one of the true real estate investors that I support, and he's super amazing on all of his platforms of showcasing the tried and true stories of what a day in the life of a real estate investor is. He is the principal of Flywheel Equity. He's been a part of 700 units as an LP, 80 as a GP, just closed on an Airbnb in North Carolina, does a little bit of everything, but has a good time doing it. Welcome to the show, Ryan. How's it going today?
Thanks for having me, Mike. Things are going really well today. How are you?
Just living the dream one day at a time.
There we go.
But yeah, I think, Ryan, I think one thing that I think you do a phenomenal job, like I said, with your content on Twitter, LinkedIn, it's just like being real with investors. And I think one of your main points that you say is that syndications can be overrated. And I just want to kind of leave it at that and see kind of the rabbit holes we go down, because I think it's a very interesting point that not many people agree with.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in general, I like to be somewhat contrarian, not for the sake of, you know, stirring things up or generating clicks or leads or anything like that. But just, you know, when I enter into a space and I have this kind of beginner's mindset, I like to remember what I realized about the industry or about the ways of doing things that didn't seem to make a lot of sense. And so when I see a lot of people doing the same things, talking about the same things, it's a clue to me that maybe there's a lot of groupthink going on, or maybe people are kind of being funneled into the same strategy, approach, whatever. And it's really, it's a good time to kind of take a step back and say, what's going on here? Why is everybody doing the same thing? Are there better alternatives? So, you know, when I first got into multifamily several years ago, I thought syndications was it. That was the only structure, the only approach that worked for multifamily investments. What I learned, though, by doing it myself, by being both a passive investor and now on the general partnership side and being an active operator myself, is that a syndication is just one type of structure that can be used to purchase real estate, multifamily, lots of other things, companies, et cetera, right? It's a very general term. And it has some advantages around scale. It also has some disadvantages. A lot of what I do at Flywheel Equity is about bringing transparency and education to small groups of people. I prefer to work with small groups of people. It's not my dream to have thousands and thousands of units and work with thousands and thousands of investors. I would rather work with a small number of small groups of investors and know each of them individually and give everybody, you know, a lot of attention while they're part of the ownership team. And so for a structure like that, you don't need a syndication, which enforces some very clear lines between the different roles. You can actually do joint ventures, right? Which are really just smaller groups where people can have a little more access to information and even have some more responsibilities if that is in fact what those investors want. So, you know, syndications are one approach. Joint ventures are another. Owning something outright, harder to do, obviously, if you're capital constrained, that's also an option, right? So don't just get funneled into a syndication if it doesn't match your goals. And that's one of the things I try to educate people on.
Yeah, I think it's super important as like the LPM side. It's a great deal to invest truly passively. I think there's some, you know, asset management aspects where you have to keep your operators in check and follow up with them and ask them. But I don't think on the operator side, many people don't realize that if you do a 70-30 split, you own a part of the 30%. And then if you do the math, you're like, I'm doing a lot of work for a very small percentage. And so if you're truly talking about like financial freedom or wealth creation, it's, do I want to own a micro percent of a big deal, or do I want to own more of a smaller deal? So that's why when even on their Jacob Dino education side of things, people are like, I want to get 100 plus units. And it sounds like every podcast that we've ever listened to just for the scale. But what does it mean for you, and what do you want? And thinking that end of mind, that's important. And as you grow in scale, you can grow bigger because you've built that foundation and the fundamentals. But I think that's just a very critical point that not many people think about when going on the syndication route.
Oh, yeah. I mean, don't get me started on the financial success that you may or may not achieve as a GP. Like if you're starting off and you've been pulled in by a group or a social media post, and you're looking at these multifamily people thinking, oh man, like look at their lifestyle, look at how well they're doing. They've got thousands of units. I want to be like them. If you look at the number of units you have to be an active operator and have a meaningful percent of before you get to anything that looks like lifestyle independence and cash flow that's meaningful enough to support a lifestyle, it's going to take a lot of work, many years. You know, real estate is a slow build kind of asset. And so if you're on the operator side, if you're a GP, your LPs get the returns first, right? There might be small fees here and there that you get. Yes, absolutely. But if you're talking about sustainable cash flow, it's going to take a long time unless you just come out of the gate super strong or have just huge ownership percents of whatever structure you're you know going into. It's going to take a long time to establish cash flow because you know, especially looking at value add stuff, your LPs, first of all, there's not going to be a huge amount of cash flow coming out in the early stages of the ownership period. Your LPs probably have some sort of pref, so they're getting first stab at those returns. And then the rest of the returns, again, it varies by structure, but the rest of the returns are split between the GPs and the LPs. And the GPs tend to be a group of people, not just one person, right? So if you're a part of a general partnership, really look at the math. I mean, it's not a get rich quick scheme at all. You've got to love the process. You have to really believe in the asset class because it's a long-term play. So don't be fooled by all the glitzy, fancy stuff you see out there. Being a GP, being an operator is a total grind.
And plus, I think thinking that investor first, your investors are your boss. And I think of it as like that asset manager role. It's like the investors keep you accountable. You have to keep your property management accountable and you work all together. But in the end, your LPs are your boss. And I think when you take on other people's money, that's an aspect that people overlook very quickly because it's like, oh, I get this ACT fee. Yeah, no one cares when you get the ACT fee. They care about quarter one distributions, quarter two. Hey, I have a tax issue. I have a K-1 issue. And they're like, what did I just sign myself up for? And it can be overwhelming. And I mean, I love our investors and they're great, but if you're starting new and you're like, I'm going to raise money, I'm going to do this, like you need a lot of legal syndication attorneys, not just throwing stuff on Facebook and Instagram that not many people, like that structure piece is just so important. So
there's a lot of infrastructure you need to have in a place to properly support a dozen, two dozen, 50 plus investors, right? When was the last time you had a job where you had 20 bosses? Probably never. And there's a reason, because that just doesn't work, right? That's a terrible, terrible place to work. But when you're a GP and you're trying to go big right out of the gate and you don't have that infrastructure in place, you know, it's really 20 plus people that are coming to you, asking things of you, and you have responsibilities to all of them. So definitely keep that in mind.
Yeah. Coming from the LP side to the GP side, what was either a hurdle that you had like mentally or once you dove in that you kind of like, oh my gosh, what am I getting myself into? Because obviously you overcame it, but what's that initial hurdle? Because I know a lot of people who are successful start as LPs, but I think kind of that getting the ball rolling on the active side.
You know, I don't know if it's just a sign of our times or maybe a particular weakness of mine, but the amount of investment and work that goes into identifying an acquisition, right? Getting your hands on that first acquisition, it's super hard, right? Like you as an LP, I know my inbox is filled every week with new investment opportunities. So it's like, okay, man, there's tons of people, tons of groups out there that are identifying new opportunities for me to invest in. Probably is not going to be that hard for me to identify opportunities for my investors, you know, in whatever locale or geography or asset class I'm looking at. But, you know, those groups may have established infrastructure, may have established relationships, and maybe have done business for years and years and years and have a lot of success in an area and have brokers coming to them with pocket listings and whatnot. They probably have competitive advantages that you may not, especially when you're starting out. So it was a real struggle. It took a lot of work to get the first acquisition in place. And honestly, even today, you know, we've done about three transactions, all the smaller size, because again, we like to do more JVs and focus on some kind of under identified assets and areas is where we find opportunities. Even today, I can't say we have a proven, consistent, repeatable process for finding acquisitions. Every time we get one, it feels like it's luck, right? We just happened upon this at the right time. You know, if it hadn't have happened to talk to this one person, or if my director of acquisitions hadn't happened to have sent this one email at this right time, this, you know, we would have never seen this. So that the amount of work and the planning and the time it takes to pay off on the acquisitions front is really something that surprised me going from an LP to a GP.
Yeah. And it is funny because you see all these people doing deals. And even when I first got started, I was like, I see everyone closing deals, but I feel like I'm lost at sea going like, what the heck? What's going on? And like, you just got to.
Am I on a blacklist somewhere? It's like, why is nobody talking to me?
I feel like in a black hole. That was my 2020. I was just like, what is going on? Like, but it's funny if you just keep your head down and just kind of incrementally get that progress of calling the brokers. Even like in new markets, I'd call every 3 weeks and they're like, we'll let you know when we get a deal. And I'm like, perfect. I'll call you in 3 weeks. Cause I just want staying on top of mind is such a thing. And I'm just like a systems person where I'm like, well, if I call them every month, like I even did the math yesterday, is you call them four or like several more times more by calling every 3 weeks instead of every month. So it's just finding that competitive edge, being quick to the game, all the stuff I'm sure you're like, you've learned in that first acquisition is huge. But like you said, every close is insane for no reason. Like something happened in the last 7 to 14 days that could have been avoided. But even on our closes, I'm like, well, nothing bad's happened yet. And it's like 5 days before, I'm like, well, I'm just not going to sleep the last three, I guess. And we got it done.
Yeah. I feel like going through a close is an act of perseverance. It's an act of being able to, having the mindset of why will this deal work, not why won't this deal work, right? Because there are always little wrinkles and whatnot that are thrown in there, and you have to figure out, okay, this is just a problem to solve. It's not a reason to completely back away. And that doesn't mean there aren't reasons to back away, but in general, your mindset has to be pretty optimistic.
Yeah, and you won't get a ton of sleep, and don't ever travel or schedule vacation. We've almost had like a partner do that, and they had to stop on it off a train, hop back on just to sign documents. And like, are we flying to New York today to get this done? Like, every close is a marathon when you least expect it. And no matter how many times you ask the lenders, it's a fun ride. So that's why when people are like, how do you earn your fees? We're like, well, getting the close is a big enough deal. So.
And you know, the funny part is too, like that there's so much work and discussion and celebration that goes into getting to the point of close. Guess what? Congratulations. Now the actual work begins. Now you own the thing, and now it's on you to actually manage, operate, put in property management. Like if you took a step back and looked at the arc of time, you know, 1% of the time got you to close. Now you've got 99% of the time and work left, but there is such a compressed, there's such compression that happens at the acquisition as far as work and all that needs to happen. And it's such a binary, you know, win lose, whether you make that happen or not, that a lot of attention gets put there. And, you know, one of the things that we're doing at Flywheel Equity is wanting to become just really good at operations of a specific type of kind of value add property here in Central North Carolina and making sure that we are not underemphasizing the actual work on the ground that happens post-close, post put on social media that celebrates the close, right? It's like, yeah, now the real work begins.
Yeah, it reminds me of Shark Tank. You worked so hard to get to that deal and you got the deal. And now we're like, oh shit, I took money from Mark Cuban. Now I really got to keep going. So there's that aspect, but I think it's very interesting that you said it's like very binary because it's the investor either is investing or isn't. They did or they didn't. The lender agrees or didn't. It appraised or didn't. And so you're just in a 60-day window of yeses or nos, and you're just like on to the next one. And it's a very interesting, very binary race for 60 days or even less if you're closing sooner. But I really like that perspective. And I think too, the groundwork was very interesting because a lot of people starting off just go, oh, if I just cut my loss to lease in half, then my valuation goes up. Or if I just change my rents to this, then this happens, which I think leads to, you know, another point we were talking about before the call was IRR and how that could be manipulated on a spreadsheet. I don't know how that could happen. But what are your thoughts on IRR? Because I've seen Twitter threads about it, LinkedIn threads, and people boasting IRRs. What is your contrarian thought when it comes to IRR?
Yes. So I have lots of thoughts on this. I've done several talks on the matter that have kind of been refined over time. You can go on my YouTube to look at some of those. But to summarize, I don't have any beef with IRR, the calculation, right? I think it is a valid way to understand your time-weighted returns of a particular asset. And it's a good or an apples-to-apples comparison across asset classes because it takes into account cash flow as well as appreciation. My concern is more around the investor mindset. You know, as an LP, as somebody who's going to invest in other people's deals, how you're judging the quality of that deal and why you are investing in the asset class itself, right? So to kind of start with the micro or the tactical, the IRR is a number that takes into account cash flows. It also takes into account appreciation at exit. And most deals do have some cash flow, and it varies by ratio, but will also have the majority of the returns generated at exit. And anytime you are relying on forward-looking projections to come up with what you think your return would be, it's just folly. It's just folly. I look at every single multifamily deal, whether it's syndication, JV, whatever, just the underlying performance compared to what the pro forma, what the projections were going in. On day one of close, on month one, your projections and reality are wildly divergent across 20 different line items. Okay. Planning is everything, but plans are crap. That's like a military saying from World War II. So you have to put your projections in place. You have to know what you're getting into. You have to do your due diligence and really understand this is what this deal looks like and what we think we can do with it. But then to rely on the next 5 years of performance projections and think that that's going to even closely resemble what your end returns are going to be is ludicrous. So my approach and what I talk a lot about is, how can you come up with some measure of the quality of this deal that does not rely on forward-looking projections, which are subject to huge macroeconomic trends, interest rate trends, demographic.
Epidemic, per se.
Exactly. Things like that. You just don't know what's, I barely know what interest rate's going to be in 1 year, and certainly nobody knows in five, right? The marketplace is littered with false projections just everywhere, right? And so we still look at measurements that measure the relative value and of a particular asset, but we use things like yield on cost or return on cost. These are measurements which we have a much greater sense of on day one of ownership. They don't rely on that exit price or the appreciation, right? So we use those types of metrics. Now, what you lose is a lot of the upside that comes with your capital appreciation projections, right? So, and that brings us to the other point, which is around why would you be investing in real estate? I don't think investors should be investing in real estate chasing returns. Okay. If you're comparing one multifamily deal to another and one is showing a 14.8% IRR and the other is showing a 13.2%, that should not be a factor in your decision making. Okay. Trust me, they're both going to be off by 5%+, probably even 10%+ in either direction. Not just bad. I'm not just talking bad. You know, if you look at the last 5-10 years, everybody's hitting returns 10%+ IRR above their projections. Believe me, if they knew they were going to do that well, they would have changed a lot of things about it. They would have kept more of the deal. Like it's just wildly divergent.
They all would have bought everything.
Exactly. So nobody truly knows. So I think investors should be getting into real estate because they're going to get good stock market comparable returns, whether that's 8, 10%, whether that's 15, 18, 20%, it's going to be comparable. They're going to get it with less volatility. They're going to get it with much less downside, and it's going to be a much more stable, steady trajectory, return trajectory. Okay. So that's one component of a portfolio. So that's why you should be investing in real estate. Not because you think you can get 14.2% on this compared to the 13.8% in some other in some other deal. So those are kind of the two mindset things around investors, what they have, they value a particular deal, then how they think about their real estate investments in general that I really push against.
Yeah, I think that's a huge piece, because when I first started being a CPA, I was always like numbers, numbers, numbers. And then I realized the more 2 years of underwriting, it's the, does the story check out? It's truly the ability to increase rents or other income, which I think is another avenue a lot of investors underuse when it comes to increasing the value. And then the expenses is how to mitigate them, because we've seen bloated people use billboards in Lexington, Kentucky to market apartments. So it's like, how do we run this operational efficiency? I think it's just like checking the box of the story. And like you said, the asset class, the market, submarket, the property itself, like buying a 1950s asset or a 1900s asset, thinking you need $2,000 a door just to paint carpet, it's not gonna, probably not gonna cut it. So I think that aspect is very interesting, and I totally agree. The story has to make sense, not necessarily all the numbers, because even then IRR assumes mathematically that there's a consistent deliverable throughout the investment deal. And I think it's modified IRR is the more correct of the, I'm sure, countless IRRs. So it's not always about and plus two, like you said, you have 20 variables that can change at any given time. Like we close a deal in Lexington and the state goes, oh, our water bill is going to go up 7%. It's like, oh, we didn't underwrite that, but you know, we can't just say, oh, we can't buy it anymore. Right. So it's just how do you mitigate that cost? I mean, we increased our RUBS, but it's still just another aspect of your pro forma is great until you buy it. And then it's that execution piece that you really can go through, and it doesn't have to be pretty. And I think, like you said, with your aspect of transparency and telling investors on the front end instead of kind of smoke and mirrors of it's going great, but we're only paying 6 or 8% and all these other things, I think it allows vulnerability and transparency that helps investors get comfortable with you, because in the end, not every deal is going to be a grand slam, but as long as you're upfront with it and telling investors, I think they can go get it along board alongside that.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I am in several deals as an LP, so I'm one of dozens of investors into some larger deals. And you know, looking at the projections versus the reality, like after the first year of ownership, you know, I have some where we're underperforming by 20%, right? The expected NOI versus reality is down by 20%. That's a severe miss that I didn't get a peep from the GPs, right? I had to go digging into the financials myself to say, okay, well, I wonder how we're doing compared to what we projected, what was in the offering memorandum. And it's off by 20% to the negative, right? I would have expected to kind of have a thoughtfully, and I'm not saying that means the deal is going to be bad, but certainly that's a point in time wrinkle that you would want to discuss with your limited partners.
It might be material.
It's material to me, right? And so I, you know, the way I run my deals is you get a lot more details. You could ignore a lot of it if you want to have more of a passive role. But I'm going to tell you if we're not hitting these projections, or if overall things are going well, but underneath, you know, the second level of metrics or things that we're tracking, we're underperforming by this. You're always going to be underperforming in some aspect. Hopefully, it's just covered up by the fact that you're overperforming in others. And so it's really important to me to have relationships with investors where I feel comfortable going to them saying, hey, this is not working well, or this is the true state of things. And I know that they're going to treat it like a partnership, like a discussion, a rational discussion, and doesn't mean they can't ask critical questions, but you know, it's not something that I need to feel like I have to hide from investors. That would be a condemnation of my ability to run a deal, and then also the relationship I have with the investors, and that's just not where I want to be.
Yeah, I think being on both sides now, how much communication do you think is like the right level for you as an LP, we'll say? Not because everyone, it's impossible, but for you as an LP, what have you found to be the perfect kind of communication rhythm or sequence?
So on my deals, I actually create a Slack group where we can chat and I can drop in granular details. You know, if I happen to do a site visit and drop in some pictures of the latest rehab or things like that, things that maybe wouldn't make it into a monthly or quarterly newsletter. I like to provide different levels of frequency and transparency, and people can opt into which level is right for them. So that way I'm not making a decision on behalf of the LPs as far as what they want. So it really does vary. I think more than the frequency, what's important is the tone and the transparency. I get monthly newsletters from the aforementioned deals I'm in, and it's the same email with two numbers replaced every time. That is such a low value, you know, monthly newsletter for me that it's like, what, I'd rather you just not even send it. So it's really more about the quality of the content and the transparency than the frequency.
Yeah, no, that's a good piece, because for the JV deal I'm doing, we're recording like our property manager calls and just kind of posting on a private YouTube channel. It's a good idea with the Slack, because then it allows interaction between partners as well. And so I think that's definitely a very interesting avenue for investors, just to be like, hey, here's, because you're creating a community. And when it's all said and done, you're doing it for your residents, you're doing it for investors. And whether an investor invests with you or someone else, they're still your investor through and through. And, you know, having, that's the beauty of real estate, is having that growth mindset piece of constantly helping each other through the ways, especially with COVID, and helping people who've been in your shoes were like, I bought a 12 unit. I'm a nurse. I don't have time to do anything. Can you help me? And it's like, yeah, we got you. Here's all the stuff we use. Like, go for it. So that's the one thing.
It really establishes a sense of team, which is a lot of fun to see the group come together like that.
And it's abundance too. Cause like you look at like the tech startups of like who raised the most money to do this thing. And it's like a race versus like, oh, Ryan, I can introduce you to this investor who's looking to do this. And it's just like it's such a team sport that there's not too many people are like, I'm not going to help you. So it's a very interesting environment that I'm blessed to be in every day.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So Ryan, we've talked about different asset classes, but what are your kind of thoughts on multifamily right now? We know we opened the show mentioning your Airbnb, but you know, love to kind of see your forecasts on multifamily, because obviously being an owner, working in acquisitions, but kind of what is your kind of thesis when it comes to multifamily moving forward?
Yeah, I love multifamily as an asset class for its long-term demographic support. I think renters by need and by lifestyle are only increasing. And you know, it still is a locale-specific thing, right? So would I buy multifamily in Flint, Michigan, or do I think it's got a good run ahead of it? Probably not. No harm to Flint, Michigan. I don't know much about it, but you know, from what I've seen,
you get the idea. Not... I'm from Michigan. You got it. You nailed it. I support it.
But you know, somewhere in one of the metros you've seen in the Southeast or surrounding areas, there's a lot of these, you know, pro growth, low tax, good landlord friendly, high population growth states. I think multifamily has a lot of room to run. I also think it is being highly, highly valued by investors. And so it is really hard to find the types of deals that you have found in the last couple of years. You know, if you get into a multifamily deal and you're doing, and you walk out with 10, 12% or so returns over the next 5 years, I think you should be really happy with that, right? Returns, expectations have gotten compressed, yield has gotten compressed, and that's absolutely flowed into real estate and multifamily in general. So family is the tool. Real estate is the general asset class. And so what I think a lot about, and I've talked to other operators about as well, is like, okay, you know, we have learned a lot about multifamily and how to run, you know, mini private equity type deals, JV syndications, et cetera. But those structures and those approaches are not just for buying multifamily. Those can be used and leveraged to invest in lots of different asset classes. So I've spent the majority of this year really looking around real estate and mostly commercial real estate, but looking around real estate for, okay, if I feel like multifamily is fully valued, won't say overvalued, but fully valued.
I'm going to use that.
and it's hard to find great deals. There's got to be other opportunities within real estate, right? The markets are not uniform. So am I just going to, as an operator, sit here banging my head against the same wall, or am I going to try to change up what I do? And so, you know, at this point, I've invested as an LP in multifamily, as a GP in multifamily. I've done a single family in the past, and I started looking at short-term rentals. I feel like with every asset class, and we've seen this with mobile home parks and self-storage, those used to be kind of castaway asset classes, kind of looked down upon in the commercial real estate industry. But what we've seen over the last couple of decades is they're becoming discovered. They're becoming more professionalized. The marketplace is becoming more mature. And when that happens, you get this compression, the cap rate compression, right? When bigger people come in, they start buying, they start bringing their economies of scale and whatnot. And so the valuations start to go up. So there's an institutionalization that happens with asset classes that if you're an early investor, you can take advantage of. Multifamily's taken advantage of it. And again, self-storage, mobile home parks have taken advantage of it recently. So I was kind of looking around for, you know, are there other similar asset classes that maybe could take advantage of this trend? And the best that I could see, and self-storage, I think it's definitely already happened with self-storage. I still definitely like it. But the other was short-term rentals. And I thought, okay, is there a way that I could combine my commercial real estate mindset with short-term rentals, which are still very much, I mean, I come from a technology background. To me, short-term rentals are just a super well-known type of property, type of asset. But if you look at the ecosystem around it, whether it's lending or insurance or things like that, it's actually still quite new. And so I found a short-term rental property in the mountains here in North Carolina. It's actually a 5-cabin property. So it qualifies as a commercial property, but it just happens to have the short-term rental business plan layered on top of it. And so I purchased that about a month ago, and I'm kind of just myself and am running that as, I won't say an experiment, that implies that I could lose it and be fine with it. That would definitely not be the case, but as a way for me to just explore this type of asset class that I think long-term will start to benefit from increased in institutionalization. And, you know, if I bought it at a 12 cap this year, in 5 years, I could absolutely see it being an 8 cap. And I hope I'll have operational improvements as well. I'm not just relying on appreciation, but, you know, in the meantime, have amazing cash flow and get in early on what I think might be kind of a new asset class that will kind of grow up over the coming years.
Yeah. And I think that's a great way, like framework too, of the institutionalization of like a lot of asset classes, like obviously multifamily. I think everyone's kind of understood by that, but like mobile home parks as well, self-storage, but it's like they all, everything comes consolidated. Like the Rockefellers, like they just take over and never let go. And I think too, it's like, yeah, how do you grow up with an asset class of the institutionalization? And I think given your background, I think nerding out in the Airbnb space, short-term rental space would be fun, of just the different technologies and that consolidation and the insurance. And banks and insurance are always the last to change. So
right.
If we have anything to do about it, we can help circumvent that and make it grow faster. But there's a lot, I think similar to everything else, if you get the management down and the systems in place, you can easily 10x, 100x your growth. And like you said, on top of that, cap rate compression, have a larger institutional buyer, your cap rate's even less. And I think it'll be okay.
Yeah, you know, I think that the long-term goal there would be, you know, if I get a year or two of operations of this property under my belt, I feel good about it. I'm able to grow it and have something that I think is replicable. Then the goal would be, okay, how can I scale up with this? You know, can I make this a 20 property or 20 cabin property or amass a portfolio of 20 properties in the mountains and sell it as a portfolio, just like people do nowadays with industrial properties or self-storage, right? They grow to a big portfolio little by little, and then they can exit to a much bigger player who has the means and the willingness to pay a higher price. So that's a long-term goal, but it is one of many playbooks that I think could happen.
Yeah. And I think too, my long-term thesis of how the world will look like is, I think leases will be gone. It'll all be short-term rentals because of just the ability to move. The mobility will increase. I think more and more people become freelancers. I mean, there'll be few contracted people, or it could be like day-to-day contracts. So that's kind of just the increased mobility, the internet piece allows everyone to work anywhere. I think 2020 proved that. And I don't really ever see it disappear, but I also don't think offices will disappear as well. So it's just,
right.
I think you're, and I like calling it an experiment because it is, because you're proving out your hypothesis with your thesis by just doing a 5-unit. And obviously it would hurt, but I think it's just also, you're just proving out your hypothesis. So I think it's a really good framework that not many investors have, because they just like, I need to make money. It's like, no, let's see if this works. You know, let's play, gamify it, have fun with it. But I think it's because if you're constantly just trying to make money, it knee-jerk reactions and emotion, a lot more emotions get into it.
Yeah. And, you know, I like to play with my own money before I ask investors for theirs. Right. So I like to prove out the thesis before I go to investors. You know, it de-risks it just a little bit. And so that's something that I hope to do here.
Yeah, that's awesome. So as we're kind of wrapping up, Ryan, I love the interview and the podcast, tremendous value given. But if you could give our listeners one investor pro tip, what would it be?
Don't get starstruck by return projections, by numbers. Understand what you're investing in at a deeper level. Understand why that asset class makes sense for your portfolio. It's not all about that top line return. There's so much more that goes into good diversified portfolio construction. So that's a bit of a wonky, boring answer, but I see a lot of people chasing numbers and think that gets people into trouble.
I thought you were going to say, don't be starstruck when you have me on your investor call.
Nope. Definitely wouldn't say that.
No, that's great, Ryan. Thank you so much for being on. If investors want to get to know you, what's the best way they could reach? And we'd love to plug the Airbnb as well, or the short-term rental. So happy to do so. Anyway, sure, if you're looking for a little getaway coming up.
There you go. To find me, go to flywheeleq.com. It's flywheel, the letters EQ, short for equity, flywheeleq.com. If you are looking for a couples getaway in the mountains of North Carolina, go to hotspringslogcabins.com, sign up, and we'd love to have you. Bring your pets and enjoy a couple days up in the mountains.
Perfect. Well, I appreciate it, Ryan. Thank you so much for being on. And if anyone has a question for me, please reach out to me at mikeT@rancre.com. And until then, we'll see you next week.